management in the UK. Just some background, all lines have been placed on listen-only mode for this call. Investors that want to ask questions may do so by entering your question into Aramark Questions in the lower right part of your screen. Before we get started, I'd like to remind everyone that our conference call series, and this call in particular, should not be considered a solicitation of proxies by Glass Lewis & Co. Glass Lewis has not sought permission to do so from the SEC, nor will it. This call is for informational purposes only. It should not be construed as providing investment advice. In addition, Glass Lewis makes no representation regarding the accuracy, completeness, or reliability of any statement, information, opinion, or views presented by its guest speakers. As a reminder, we are recording this call. It will be available on the Glass Lewis website and our blog late this afternoon. So background, I'm Bob McCormick, Chief Policy Officer, and what we thought is we wanted to have a discussion about some of the developments in remuneration in the UK, particularly around engagement and some of the developments there. So we're very pleased to be joined by Paul Emerton, Head of UK Stewardship and Governance with Old Mutual Global Investors, and David Snade, who's Corporate Governance Analyst with Fidelity International Limited. Joining me are my colleagues, Peter Riley, Senior Research Analyst, and Dmitry Zagorov, Manager of UK and European Compensation. Just some brief background. So this year, 2015, was the second year of the new voting structure in the UK, where shareholders get a binding vote on the forward-looking remuneration policy, along with the longer-standing annual advisory vote, which has in some ways been reframed as a vote on the implementation of the policy. So in addition to the new binding proposal and the adoption of the stewardship code, there's been an increased focus on engagement and stewardship really throughout the UK market in recent years, and Fidelity and Old Mutual are really leaders in that respect. So Paul and David can discuss their firm's campaigns to promote changes to company pay structures, as well as compensation-related stewardship and engagement more generally, and then also some recent developments in the UK executive pay landscape. So if you have any questions today, please use the question box on the webinar. But at this point, I'd like to turn it over to David to kick things off. Maybe you can give us some background on, you know, how Fidelity has been looking at these sort of issues and what the results have been in your engagements with companies. Are there specific issues that you tend to focus on during your discussions?
Yeah, great. Hi, everyone. One thing that the new legislation has kind of knitted in very neatly with actually our own engagement campaign that we've been pursuing here at Fidelity. Back in 2012, we sat down and we're very much thinking about the landscape in which executive pay was. It was politically sensitive, and we actually felt that there'd been a market failure of some respect. Effectively, the level of quantum that was being paid was just very much out of step of what we were comfortable with, and more importantly also what our clients were comfortable with. We very much felt that actually we should be taking more of an active stance on trying to look into this thing. And when we looked at this question, it's very difficult to turn around to a company and effectively just say to them, okay, we want you to all take a pay cut. We thought that wouldn't be very effective at all. I can't imagine either you and I would take that request very well. We particularly looked at instead the structure, and we were trying to think about how can we get the best bang for buck. Where we came out with this whole thinking was actually looking at the concept of long-term pay. As far as remuneration packages are concerned, we've always thought that long-term incentive plans really are the best system of aligning with our own interests, effectively normally being equity-based. Being very much linked to the long-running, long-term performance. And as generally long-term investors, that's definitely where we want to focus our attention. But we particularly felt that the three-year time horizon that had developed in the UK was not particularly what we defined to be long-term. What we really wanted to do was actually move that more towards a five-year horizon, and we came up with a policy whereby we decided that come a certain point in time, we wanted there to be a five-year period between which awards were granted and when they were actually eligible to be sold by participants. So effectively exposing executives to a five-year movement in the share price. So if the share price had gone down in those 5 years and we'd suffered, likewise the value of the awards would go down, and vice versa. Obviously we want there to be reward for where there's been good performance. So we wrote to companies, we're mainly focusing on Europe, and we wrote to about the top 500 companies in 2012. Sort of requesting a voluntary introduction of this. That didn't really get too much of an uptake. So when we actually got to later that year, we decided actually quite rare for us, we would make this into what we call a red line issue. We put a line in the sand and effectively wrote again in 2013 and actually said that by 2015, we wanted this to be in place or else we wouldn't be supporting the remuneration arrangements and kind of elevated to a point where actually even if we were content with other parts of the package, we saw this as something very core to how we think pay should be structured, and therefore we would actually not be supporting even if everything else was okay. And likewise, we wanted to give credit where it was adopted and effectively say that we saw a five-year share price alignment go some way towards overcoming some of the imperfections of trying to, for example, always set relevant targets and always trying to hit the right balance. So we effectively drew a line in the sand. We wrote to all our main holdings and said that by 2014 we were looking for more than 3 years, so we sort of gradually introduced this policy, and then 2015, this year being the crunch year, where we were looking for a five-year period. One thing that was particularly good about the way this was implemented was it was actually very much owned by a chief investment officer who effectively was the face of this policy. It wasn't just something that came from the governance team. It wasn't just something that came from our department. It was actually something that we had buy-in internally from the CIO down to the individual fund managers and also the analysts. I think being a red flag issue, when we always consult internally on any vote that we do, and it was important to have them on side behind this idea, given how often it would lead us to voting against. So where's this got us to? The other part of it is we tried to be quite public in terms of with putting out press releases, updating on the campaign. We obviously want to sing about where we've had success, and actually we feel like particularly in the UK, we've seen quite a lot of movement. What this generally looked like is the introduction of holding periods following vesting. So you still get the typical three-year performance period in place, but actually there's a further 2 years where any vested shares must be held, exposing to a further 2 years and getting us to that five-year point. A few numbers I've got here. So in 2013, where we started, we had four companies in the FTSE 100 had a five-year horizon in place. Now we're currently looking at about 42%, and in the FTSE 350, we've seen a similar kind of uptick, you know, moving from just a handful of companies, and I think we're currently looking at well over 60 in the FTSE 350. We've seen a few more move to more than three, but not all to 5 years, but we're sort of constantly encouraging them to move in that direction. And finally, we're just thinking a little bit about where we're going to take this from now on. Certainly in the UK, the adoption has been quite high. In Europe, we've seen some more proactive international focused companies adopting it, but that's still quite a lot to figure out there. And finally, we're just thinking a little bit about what the future looks like for this policy. Maybe we want to look into post-retirement or post-departure holding periods. But we don't want to rush too far ahead of the curve. We want to make sure that actually this is getting well established. And that's what we've been up to at Fidelity.
Gotcha. I had a couple questions that kind of occur to me. You know, obviously when you're bringing in your fundamental analyst team, and I'm sure they're looking at companies based on the particular industry, where there's some industries, maybe like oil and gas, that have very long-term time frames that maybe were more receptive, and those that were maybe more high-tech that felt that 5 years was really too long a time frame? Or was there kind of a general feeling that, with the holding period, post-performance period, that sort of mitigated some of those issues?
Yeah, I think one thing that was quite effective about the policy was that we weren't going out there and saying, for example, we want you to set a five-year performance period. So to suddenly say all management everywhere has a line of sight 5 years ahead of today, I think would be quite ignorant. Effectively, because we were building it more into the structure of how an individual held the shares for, I think because we were going for a five-year personal share price alignment with the individuals, it didn't feel like there were too many industries where actually you would complain about a CEO being aligned for 5 years, as opposed to then suddenly trying to capture the rest of, what year four or five would it like in terms of targets. So I think that went some way, and different markets have adopted it in different ways. In France, for example, typically the performance period is 4 years with a lot of cases due to legacy tax laws, and they've added a one-year holding period to meet our requirements. So that there is still a bit of flexibility regarding implementation that I think has helped a lot.
Ah, now that's a good point. In general, would you say different markets have different receptivity to either holding periods or lengthening performance periods?
Yeah, one of the really interesting things that's actually come through this exercise is the concept of long term actually looks quite different in different markets. So the UK, when you look at it in a lot of ways, was actually quite unique in actually seeing the long term as just a 3-year period without any additional holding periods in place. When we started rolling it out across Europe, we found that a lot of markets were already actually thinking very much, oh, we should be looking at 5 years. You know, the Dutch Corporate Governance Code already makes explicit reference to looking at 5 years, and the 5-year kind of idea was already very much out there, which has helped a lot in some markets. But then you will always find that others where sort of international engagement may be a bit more difficult. So it's, like all these things, it kind of comes down to the appetite for management in a lot of ways to actually want to kind of listen to feedback and react to it.
Sure. Dimitri or Peter, do you want to jump into any specific questions for David?
Yeah, David, this is Dimitri Zagorov with Glass Lewis. Just wondering, clearly there's sort of an emphasis here on encouraging the longer-term outlook in pay. For companies that were maybe resistant to extending the performance or holding period, are there other structural elements that you'd consider that might mitigate that? I'm thinking in particular sort of high share ownership requirements or just existing higher share ownership levels. Or was it more a case of just taking a hard line on this and sort of drawing a line in the sand?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And actually, from when we first started engaging on this, that was effectively pointed towards as kind of how companies were already trying to put this in place. I think 2 points, really. Firstly, we kind of wanted to take an approach that was very much more baked into the nature of the policy itself. I think it's a much more bold statement to effectively say this long-term plan has a 5-year horizon in place. The problem with we found often with shareholding requirements is firstly, normally they can be quite low, particularly in the UK you're looking at maybe 1 or 2 times salary. And if you consider that when you get to the FTSE 100 companies, you're looking at grant levels of many multiples, two and a half times up to sort of 8 times salary, then it really doesn't take long before those are met, and actually there's no more sort of binding kind of condition upon it. And we also wanted to kind of remove it from the personal circumstances of an individual, as I said, kind of focus much more on it's a 5-year plan, you should be thinking 5 years, and in that respect, the only time we ever really saw an exception is if you get into certain markets like France and Italy, where you get a lot of family markets, where the CEO effectively has 20% of the company behind him, and that's his personal wealth, then there's a strong argument there that the alignment is already there. At the same time, we kind of had to draw a line in the sand, practically speaking, on those companies where what if a CEO only owns 0.5% of the share capital of the company, is that enough? What's the value of that? So we tried to set the bar quite high because we do think it's something that should be applied reasonably across the board.
Okay. I guess, Paul, maybe we can turn to you now and maybe you can bring us up to speed on and developments at your firm and what you're seeing in your engagements and you know, results from companies you know, following the engagement. Paul, are you still there?
I'm sorry. There was actually some. Forgive me. Something come up on my screen that I urgently had to look at. Our policy, one of the things I will emphasize early on is that I have spent most of my career working on the UK and have continued to work on the UK. Perhaps it's a little disappointing that there's still enough work to do in the UK without having to look at other markets. So therefore, forgive me if my perspective does come across as just being too UK focused. The issue on which we took a stance earlier this year was on service contracts for executive directors. Practice in the UK is that directors shouldn't have a contract of more than 1 year. What's the implication in respect of pay? Well, generally that will mean that directors, when they're fired or however it may be described, in some cases retired, but generally it's just when they're fired, they can receive compensation of at least 1 year's salary potentially something as compensation for a foregone bonus, the share award and so forth, vest and benefits. In February, a company, Tesco PLC, for those not based in the UK, a UK supermarket, replaced the CEO and the CFO, and between them they received approximately £2 million in compensation, £2 million in compensation, on the back of their one-year service contracts. Given the performance of Tesco, given the state in which they left Tesco, these sums were just, I think, for a lot of the population, outrageous. And therefore, we took the view that, what was the problem here? The service contract was the problem, and therefore, we came out with a statement that by next year, we expect and will, in essence, be voting against companies unless they are reducing the notice period for directors to a notice period substantially below 1 year. We didn't set a specified time, but we just didn't. I particularly want to see companies moving below 1 year. We've had some engagement on the companies where we have holdings on it. I have also done some presentations, and generally, I think it's demonstrating the point that David made, whereby Fidelity wanted to avoid saying to directors to take a pay cut. Well, in essence, cutting the service contracts, particularly from 6 months to from 1 year to say 6 months, the perception of companies and the directors is that they were being asked to take a pay cut. So it has not been very well received.
Paul, if I could just ask you, this is Dimitri again. We often see companies sort of commit to making changes to service contracts when they bring in a new executive, but mm-hmm. declining to renegotiate the contracts of existing executives.
Yeah.
Do you sort of view legacy contracts as a reasonable barrier to immediate changes?
I'm finding that the barrier is more substantial than that. If it's to be effective, there would need to be a general move down in contracts, simply because it takes, well, the average director is in place for 5 years, and 5 years, there's an opportunity to move more quickly than that. Some companies will simply object to the principle anyway. They're concerned about risk, or they're concerned about the risk to their own personal wealth. Their perception that this is really hurting them, well, it's not. The only time it's really going to kick in is if they mess things up. And I'm finding, and it's been said to me by a number of non-executives, some of them who I've known for a good number of years and engaged with for many years, they don't want to have the conversations with the directors, with the executive directors. They perceive and indeed have had hostile responses, and therefore they are not having those conversations. It's disappointing. The result will be that we'll probably end up voting against a lot of companies, but given that it's my own perception that the executive pay model is far from optimal, maybe there is a case for more institutions to be voting against pay. David, in discussing Fidelity's views, recognised that I think the phrase he used was market out is out of step. That's our perception too, that the executive pay market is not in line with all our clients' interests. It's not in line with the long-term sustainable development. The long-term sustainable development of companies. Other one of the things that did drive me to suggest that, or to ask the companies to reduce notice periods is that in the UK there have been reductions in service contracts before. About 20 years ago, service contracts were, for most executive directors, 3 years. So a director got fired and they got 3 years of pay and benefits. About 20 years ago, on the back of Hermes fund managers putting out a statement and leading the market or leading the institutions, companies were forced to reduce their service contracts from 3 years to 2 years. About 10 years ago, 12 years ago, there was a move in the UK from 2 year service contracts to 1 year service contracts. Again, institutions pushing quite hard on that. This time around, it seems we have hit a barrier, or I'm certainly finding we're hitting a barrier. I shall continue engaging with companies and we will have some movement, but it's going to be a long, slow process.
Paul, you mentioned that, you know, in certain circumstances you may end up voting against either remuneration or perhaps other proposals, maybe even the directors. Now, do you find that gets more attention, you know, if there are significant abstain or against votes against the REM proposals or even a director? Or
I think particularly on the back of the legal implications of some pay votes, namely the approval of the pay policy. If that's not approved by a company, then they have to go back to shareholders and seek further approval, and that does rather concentrate the minds of the boards. And I think that legislative change has introduced a greater element of tension with companies and a greater willingness for them to try and to ensure they can get pay approval. I think it's always been the case that companies have been nervous of being defeated on pay votes, if only because it is fairly rare that companies are defeated on pay votes.
Right.
The pay vote has been in place in the UK for 10 years, and it's still only a few dozen companies where votes have actually been against the board. Nonetheless, companies do still want to avoid being put in a situation where they may well lose a pay vote. So therefore, us voting against, particularly where we have a large shareholding, I suspect it is going to, clearly we will be engaging the companies beforehand, and trying to persuade them to follow our policy, but if not, then there will be some awkward votes against,
right,
or at least votes against by us.
Okay.
I would add on the back of that that voting against is also a very good way to, you would hope with all companies you would really be communicating directly with the board, but sometimes you feel like there can be certain gatekeepers to the board, and we found this increasingly more in Europe, but still sometimes in the UK. But actually, when someone has to explain the turnout for a meeting and actually why, say, a 3 or 4% block has voted against, that's something that I think does get more attention off the board, even if maybe that was trying to be managed a little bit. That's something that it does send a much clearer message, and actually, we found, kind of voting against a lot of companies last year and actually coming back to speak with them again this year, that the message did get very clearly communicated of what our particular issue was. And actually, when we were talking to a lot of people this year, they did understand where we were coming from, and often because it had been escalated to the board because of the consequence at the AGM and how the vote had turned out.
Right. This sort of a sort of hardline approach of really threatening an against vote if certain structural changes aren't made, is this something that could have been done really well before the binding vote came in, or has that sort of afforded a bit more of a stick on your part as institutional investors to really push for change?
I It has changed the dynamic in a few cases, where boards are concerned, particularly if there is a groundswell of opinion amongst their shareholder base, and they know or are seeing signs that a sufficient number of shareholders are going to be voting against, that they may be defeated on this vote. Defeated on the pay policy vote does carry implications. They have no pay policy if it's not approved, and therefore that where there is a groundswell of opinion against a board, then they are that much more eager, I think, to try and achieve a resolution or to withdraw a proposal which appears to be unacceptable.
Okay. Conversely, do you think that having the two separate votes, one sort of binding and future-looking and the other still the old advisory vote, has that sort of changed the approach to voting amongst UK investors?
I think it's come a bit more clean-cut in some respects. It's quite helpful when we're very much looking at, we would consider the sort of the five-year time horizon and holding periods and vesting schedules to be very much more of a policy issue than necessarily an implementation one. So it's been quite helpful for us in a way, because there were several companies, particularly last year when we had more policy votes, where actually we could register that one particular point on that particular vote. But then we may also, for example, have a concern with the targets that were attached to awards granted during the year, or maybe we thought the challenge wasn't there, or we had some sort of concern. And it's actually very useful to actually have two separate votes to say, well, actually, our share retention policy, as we call it, that issue has been raised over here, but just to make you aware, don't let that bury our other concern, which we're registering on a different proposal. And so that's been very useful, because now, of course, we get to 2015, we have much fewer, very few policies to really vote on.
Mm-hmm.
Finding much more and more, actually, when it comes to voting on one item, we might actually be turning around to a company and saying, well, actually, here's a shopping list of three or four things which have kind of accumulated to our concern, rather than necessarily being able to spread it out. So in a way, I do kind of miss the policy vote in some respects, in terms of like kind of how clear it can kind of be in directing, in a pace such a broad subject, that it's very useful to have as many avenues as possible to kind of tackle it.
To reinforce, I think, what David was saying, pay is such a broad subject that it's useful to have a number of avenues, but it's also the pay provides an additional avenue to engage with the company on wider issues, in the sense that are there questions about a company's strategy and so on, and if a company has been, or if there are questions regarding the company's strategy or membership of boards, and debates about pay can lead or provide a further opening, a further opportunity to engage with the board, to debate with the board wider aspects of governance, business performance and so on, as well as simply the pay issue.
Yeah, something that Paul was referred to earlier.
Against votes that we've seen, Aviva comes to mind, and the shareholder spring were ultimately, I think, mm-hmm. more strategic votes than they were necessarily based on pay itself.
I wholeheartedly agree on that. Big features in those major votes, for example, Aviva, Trinity Mirror, it was concerned, there were very big question marks about the management and about the strategy that the management was pursuing. Of course, in those cases, and AstraZeneca too, we've seen new people come in, new CEOs, new company strategies, and generally shareholders being happier.
Yeah, coming back to something that Paul mentioned earlier, which is to do with talking to directors about remuneration, does expose something of the relationship that they have with executive management. And you do sometimes get the impression that actually I've been in meetings engaging with non-executive directors where I wonder if the opinion they're expressing is really their own, or effectively it's kind of they're either sounding out what the executive really wants and they want to see what reaction it might create, or maybe even almost that they're kind of going with what they've been told to say. And when you do make a demand or want to see some sort of change, often you do get a very honest response as full reference, which is, you know, I do not have the leverage over the management of the company to be able to make such a change, which is, from a governance standpoint, is you know, a real sort of spotlight into kind of sometimes how company cultures can be. And something as personal as pay, I think, is a good way of kind of highlighting that.
Agreed.
Now, are there situations where you would go perhaps beyond the actual remuneration votes, and if you felt that the committee wasn't responding to concerns or just simply was making poor choices in terms of the implementation of policy, or even where your sort of own engagement experience had led you to think that maybe they're not really representing shareholder interests, that you would actually target the directors themselves who serve on the committee?
I would, yes. If we evaluate that there are failings on the board or wider issues on the board, or the matter is so egregious, or the way the company, the board has reacted has been somewhat unsatisfactory, we would quite happily vote against other resolutions. What resolutions we might vote against would depend on the particular case, whether it's the directors or potentially the executive directors, potentially the members of the REMCOM or the chair of the company. It will depend on the circumstances in each and every case. But if a company is being poorly governed and voting against is the only course of action we are left with, then we will vote against everything if need be.
Yeah, that was something that we did take into account in terms of our specific share retention policy, looking at vesting periods. I think under our normal voting policy, if we have concerns over several years and we see little action, then the Remuneration Committee is definitely within our crosshairs. We did actually make an active choice to not apply that for our share retention policy, just because we were aware that we would be voting against the majority of companies to start with in the first couple of years. So we didn't necessarily want to be voting against the majority of Remuneration Committees. So that was just one kind of exception, but certainly I think Paul said it's case by case, and I think you'll find that shareholders, particularly in London, I find they do have long memories, and you know, when a non-executive director normally has had an executive career before that and maybe been at other companies, you know, their reputation does kind of go with them a bit. So you do understand kind of what you're working with, and we find with the investment team as well, they will form an opinion on management and also on the board, and that's something that we would always carry across to our voting.
One of the things that is unusual for us is that we don't actually vote against that many companies. I have been fairly company friendly for many years, so for us to make a statement that we are going to be voting against is actually quite a change for us. But Dave makes a very good point there that you need to consider who the people are on the board, and it may be that whilst we would we may disagree with what a company is proposing, we might abstain or even potentially vote in favour as a sign of good faith, or because we have a great deal of respect for the members of a board, and whilst we disagree with what they're doing on pay, for example, the overall benefit of those directors to the company is such that we will not even vote against them on the pay resolutions, never mind actually voting against the directors themselves. But it really is a case of considering each company, the discussions we've had with the company. Yes, we've got long elephantine memories going back a long way, and can remember people's record and people's records. And what we're trying to achieve ultimately are returns for our clients. And if the best way to do that is to vote for a resolution, notwithstanding it doesn't actually meet our policy, then it's in the interest of our clients to vote contrary to what we might otherwise be expected to do.
David or Paul, this is Peter Riley here from Glass Lewis. And I was just curious, do you think you've obviously cited barriers to engagement that you meet when you engage with committees? And has the stewardship code in any way, by concentrating a lot of asset managers on engagement, made any difference? Or do you think it's public campaigns that you've undertook that has made a real difference in engaging with committees and the quality of that engagement?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the stewardship code in some respect, but I think also there's been just the general kind of, the tide's kind of changed, and a lot of other things have been kind of pushing in that direction. I think one of the big things that came out of the introduction of the binding remuneration policy was that we actually found a lot more companies wanting to engage before a vote came up, many more than before, including a lot of more smaller companies, just because of the threat of some concern coming up and it being such uncharted territory. So we did find that the timing of our campaigns worked quite well in terms of just generally people are talking more and kind of wanting to kind of be more aware of possibly the views of shareholders before the meetings occur. Can I honestly say this led to a big uptick? It's hard to single out one thing. I think it's one more particular aspect as opposed to kind of just the general mood. We did certainly feel that with the stewardship code coming out, we had the backing, and we felt that actually making a policy where we knew the direct consequence would be, at least in the first couple of years, we would be voting against the majority of companies. We felt more comfortable knowing that actually we were really doing what the stewardship code kind of asked of us, in terms of actually that not holding us back from effectively doing what we thought was in the best interests of our clients, in terms of installing kind of more longer term alignment that the companies were invested in. So in that respect, it did help us feel like we were actually very much in line with kind of the overall mood, and not to be afraid to use our vote.
Yeah.
Okay. Sort of following along that topic of the stewardship code, I mean, certainly when I started looking at UK Pay, really best practice was sort of set out by the ABI, which now the Investment Management Association, mm-hmm. which sort of set out very broad principles, not particularly specifics. And then every once in a while, something would happen that was sort of egregious enough to cause a groundswell of opposition. And it seems like increasingly, both in your own firm's public campaigns, but also in sort of smaller groups, started to sort of form working groups, investors sort of coming together to try and set out new standards. What's the scope for investors themselves setting out best practice in the UK versus it sort of being coming down from regulation? And is that changing, I guess, going forward?
If I can butt in on that, I think Fidelity's example is a case that has worked whereby an institution came up with their own view, and the market generally is following. I'm aware, and indeed we have supported the stance that Fidelity have taken when we have engaged with companies, and it's achieving a degree of success. So Fidelity is an example whereby individual institutions can encourage changes in practice in the market. Well done, Fidelity.
Thank you for your two times. If only we'd solved the problem.
Yeah, indeed. there's a lot more to do, I think.
Although we would all be out of a job, so we should be careful. I think one big part of our campaign was actually sort of engaging with other investors on the particular topic. And again, I've heard Paul particularly, you know, speak as well to a group of us also in London just regarding kind of the thoughts behind the campaign. And I think, although I don't think any investors have gone as far as saying it's a red line issue as far as we're concerned, we haven't met any that have sort of disagreed with the sort of the undertone of kind of what we're trying to implement, and I'm sure that Paul can probably testify to something similar. So it helps that we're not completely out of line of what others could accept, even if maybe they're not necessarily voting in the way that we do.
I guess if building on that, as you know, as you have discussion with companies and with other shareholders, are there beyond the holding periods and shorting term of service contracts, are there other general themes that you think would be helpful for other shareholders to keep in mind that you know, shareholders are focused on and that companies are receptive to in terms of you know, structure or other aspects that have you've been successfully engaging with companies on in terms of changes or enhancements?
I'd say one of the big things that we've been trying to raise as often as we can is trying to move towards simpler pay structures. I think it often feels like there's too many elements, and actually the line of sight for executives can often get quite convoluted when there's so many plans in place, for example, or maybe a long-term incentive plan has sort of 4 or 5 performance targets attached. Sort of get to the point where actually it might dilute the effect of that. Now, that might sound a little counterintuitive given that we're asking to add holding periods to LTIPs, but actually as part of that campaign we have sort of tried to say that we would be willing to treat that as a sort of quid pro quo for moving towards a more simpler structure. So for example, if they felt that out of their 3 targets, one of them particularly was hard to predict, wasn't working, wasn't incentivizing, I think if they were to remove that, then we wouldn't necessarily see that as a bad thing as long as there was a good case for it. But it has felt a little bit like the binding pay vote in some respect has gone some way towards maybe making people a bit more nervous about innovating, a bit more nervous about kind of removing parts that are more conventional and trying anything too new. I think partly because obviously there's a binding vote attached and you don't want to remove something that someone might see as critical and annoy them to the point where you may lose the vote. But also I think having the vote every 3 years, one of the most common things that we've had raised with us this year is the company would say, okay, we appreciate your opinion, yet we're not going to look again at pay until 2017 because that's when we need the policy to go up again. So we're just going to take your view and we're going to put it in the filing cabinet and we'll open it up again in a year and a half or so when we start looking at this. So it has had the sort of possibly unintended consequence of kind of making change a little bit more difficult at times.
That last point is something that's been shot back at me by companies when asking them to look at the service contract period. They say it's a policy issue that we have said to shareholders we won't be going back to shareholders again on the policy issue for the 3-year period, so therefore it'll be 2017 before they even start to look at it.
Now, it's interesting, this year we've noticed there was a change to the UK Corporate Governance Code in the past year, recommending that pretty much all incentives be subject to recovery provisions such as clawback. And it was interesting, we found that about half of companies were quite happy to change the policy that had been approved previously and not even resubmit it, but just add clawback to that policy.
Yeah.
And about half the companies said, oh, well, we'll certainly consider it, but we can't make any changes to this policy. So I guess they're getting different legal advice on what how they can implement the policy and the introduction of clawback there. But there does seem to be a tendency to sort of say, this is what we've got, we're just going to stick with it.
Yeah,
I think the idea's got out there that changing the policy is a bad thing per se, which is a shame when you really want the policy to be changed in some respect and you might not be willing to wait 2 years for that to be the case. I think if a policy is improving, then I would be surprised that a shareholder would have a concern with it being on the agenda again, even if something positive is coming out of it.
Agreed.
But, yeah. maybe not the legitimate excuse it might first appear to be, perhaps.
Okay. Wanted to ask about one sort of specific area where we have seen quite a bit of shareholder opposition in the past year, and it's the one area of the policies that's not quite as defined. Sort of the idea behind the binding policy votes was to set out very clear limits on pay and mm-hmm. to sort of give shareholders a right to say this is what we expect to be paid, both how much and how. And the one exception to that really that we've seen is in recruitment, where most boards have retained a significant amount of discretion in terms of the awards granted to newly recruited executives. And perhaps sort of not surprisingly, we've seen quite a number of implementation advisory votes this year with high levels of opposition, where an executive received quite a significant recruitment award, and in some cases it just wasn't very well explained, and in some cases was not subject to performance. I was wondering if this is an area where more work needs to be done, and if you're comfortable with the current structure, it's just how do you sort of balance the need for board flexibility on recruitment with predictable limits and a sort of set expectation for what and how it would be paid?
I'm not sure. I suspect it's an area where we shouldn't provide a great deal of additional guidance, if only because there is a certain lack of understanding in some cases as to the a lack of understanding of the position of a company. There's one example I can think of fairly recently where somebody was recruited, compensatory awards were made because that individual had value if he had remained at the company he was working at previously. We and other shareholders viewed his appointment as very positive. After his appointment, he goes into the company, finds that there are he and the people already at the company find that suddenly they have to make a couple of profit warnings, and suddenly the value of his compensatory awards have fallen significantly. The company in question is Tate & Lyle. And therefore the board made a further additional compensatory adjustment to reflect the fact that he came into a company was compensated for his awards, and then the value of those awards were immediately undermined. In all the circumstances in that particular case, I think it was entirely fair for shareholders to support what the company had done. The individual he does appear to be a very positive appointment, and he did lose very real value that he could carry to other companies, or that he lost from his previous employment. And I would be worried if there were provisions put in place that undermined the recruitment of somebody like that. However, we've then got cases like BG Group where the numbers were huge and difficult to justify.
Yeah, I think Paul's example kind of lays out very well that it's so case by case when it comes to a lot of these things. And a lot of the time, it can be in circumstances where actually the recruitment of an individual is actually seen key as, or a new management team altogether sometimes is seen key as actually that's where maybe that's where the investment opportunity is, or maybe that's actually what's needed in order to effectively get the returns for the clients that we should be doing. So at the same time, it's very difficult to apply case by case when you're trying to fit that within the grid of a policy, which is supposed to be applying in all cases. So I am not surprised when I see some of the rather open-ended policies that are proposed, because I can imagine that it's very much trying to predict the future and try and limit future kind of recruitment awards, which is very difficult because you don't want to tie your hands when you could argue you need your hands to be as free as possible to try and catch all the balls that are falling to the ground.
Okay, and when boards are sort of having to exercise that discretion, you've obviously got a bit more a sort of a hands-on relationship with them. Do you find that they're providing enough explanation and enough sort of rationale for why they're taking these approaches? Or is that an area where sort of more disclosure and clearer communication would be helpful?
It is an area where clear communication is helpful. Certainly in the UK, sensible boards will be in contact with their major shareholders, and rather than just presenting shareholders with this is what we're definitely going to do, at least having a sensible engagement with shareholders, explaining what they're going to do, and hopefully seeking support from shareholders at an early stage, both to the recruitment of an individual and the pay arrangements, so that none of the major shareholders are surprised and that it can all go through smoothly. Sadly, in the case of BG Group earlier this year, the start of this year and end of last year, I don't think they paid a great deal of attention to what shareholders might think.
And the worst case scenario is always that you find out about this sort of thing at the bottom of the RNS that announces the appointment of a new director, which is sort of the kind of opposite end of what Paul's sort of saying should ideally happen. Is actually you might be aware of the appointment, but actually the cost that it comes at, if you have no real opportunity to consider that, then it's a very different conversation if it's already happened and you're trying to justify it, rather than the other way around, even if it's in a short time frame, that you're actually able to lay that out and as you say, approaching with some sort of indication that actually it's not a done deal, and actually there could be an opportunity for some sort of feedback and it's not just a notification.
All right, well, as we're approaching the end of our hour, I wanted to make sure if there are any outstanding issues, I think that important for our other investors to keep in mind. If there's anything you want to just kind of sum up, happy to give you that opportunity. If not, if we've really covered everything, that's fine. If I guess start with you, if there's anything you want to close on or offer.
And one that I've heard is getting more difficult, but at the same time, it's a very important one, and I think often they can be playing the role of diplomat between all the interested parties, between management and also between shareholders, who a lot of the time can have very different views. And I think at the end of the day, we would always think that the Remuneration Committee is best placed to make those calls, as they are the ones representing us as shareholders inside the company, with a bit more line of sight. But we sort of do our bit, and we like to think that we're sort of putting our voice amongst admittedly many others, but we do want to make sure that our voice is clearly understood.
David, Paul, is there any other comments you want to
offer? I look at debates on pay and where shareholders have enforced some change and so on. And as time goes by, I'm increasingly feeling like we've won a few battles, but we are being massacred in the war, that we are losing the war very heavily. Executive pay has risen substantially. Whether it is always justified, I think, going back to what David was saying, the market, I think, is out of step. I think it's not at the level at which executives are paid is not consistent with long-term returns to shareholders, with sustainability of the financial sustainability of companies. I'm concerned about points made by people such as Andrew Smithers, whereby pay structures are incentivizing executives to look at a far shorter time frame than is optimal, and that it's hitting both the UK and potentially the US markets, listed company markets. Now, what the answer might be, if that is the problem, not only for investors but also for the economies, regarding the potentially distorting effect of executive incentives, what the answer might be to that, I don't know. But it's that broader issue that the system isn't working at all well, whether it is incentivizing the right behavior, whether indeed incentives work at all as far as long-term financial sustainability is concerned. There's a lot of issues to consider there.
Okay. Well, on that encouraging note.
Sorry.
Oh, that's all right.
There are some very good companies and they're working very well, but I'm not always sure it's the pay system that has done it. And indeed, there may be examples of companies where the pay system isn't helping returns to shareholders over 20, 25, 30 years.
All right. Well, thank you both, David and Paul, for joining us and sharing your thoughts and the steps that Fidelity and Old Mutual have taken. It's been very instructive for us and hopefully for the folks on the phone. I also want to thank my colleagues, Dimitri and Peter, for participating as well. And, of course, thanks to everyone who joined the call today. Again, we are recording this, so if you missed part of the call, feel free to find the link to the audio on our blog at glasslewis.com. And if you have any further questions for us, feel free to email us at proxytalk@glasslewis.com or ideas for other proxy talks, et cetera. I do want to thank again David and Paul, Dimitri and Peter, and everyone who joined the call. Really appreciate particularly David and Paul's time. And this does conclude today's proxy talk. I wish everyone have a good day.